Yeah, my name's Philip Weatherlake, and I oversee men's ministry here at St Elf's, and St Luke's are warmly invited to everything we do. And tonight's great because we've got Shannon Hood here to join us to tell us about his life, which is a very interesting and varied life. So without further ado, get Shannon up here, and he's got a microphone in his hand. And I'll ask Shannon, what's been the most exciting thing that's happened for you in the last couple of days? You didn't know that was coming.
But, I had no idea that was coming. Exciting thing in the last couple of days. This morning I went and helped manage my son's tennis team for the first time, and that was exciting for all sorts of reasons, not all of them good, but it worked out well in the end. So that's probably the most exciting thing that's happened in the last couple of days.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you for that. I'll pray for you briefly, and then you can jump in and do your thing. And when Shannon's finished, just hold your fire. When Shannon's finished speaking, he'll speak for about maybe 35 minutes, and hopefully that's not too long, but I'm sure he'll have you sort of fixed to your seat, so don't worry about that. But at the end of it, we'll have questions. Like normal, we'll have questions and answers, and I'll run around, as I love to do, with the microphone, and people can fire questions, and Shannon will be only too happy to answer. I'll just pray for Shannon first. Father God, thank you that Shannon's been able to come tonight. Thank you for all the men that have been able to make it tonight. Bless the words of Shannon as he delivers them. May they really have impact on the spirits and souls of all the men present here tonight. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen.
I'll give you that, Phil. I think that's yours.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, Phil, and thank you for having me. It's good to be here. I will confess, though, that I'm feeling a lot more comfortable about my message tomorrow morning at St Luke's than I am about speaking here this evening. Tomorrow we'll be preaching on Psalm 128, and one of the benefits of preaching is that you can kind of look at the psalm and sort of distract the viewers from yourself, and we can explore, and I imagine that'll go up on the screen and that'll be good, and we'll talk about that, and I'll get away hopefully somewhat scot-free without any personal disclosure or revelation. Tonight I'm feeling a little nervous because it's going to be the exact opposite. I'm going to tell a little bit about my own story, and I'm just a bit concerned that some of you might be here under false pretenses, because I've seen some of the advertising that's been going up and it looks quite exciting, and someone's already described it as interesting, and I haven't said anything, Phil. Yeah, sort of setting some expectations that I may not be able to deliver on. I'm going to be talking about work, and in some of the excitement, there's been conversation about international stuff and working in Japanese factories and underground mines and all sorts of things, and all of that is true. And to be honest, gents, it would be really easy for me to tell a story that looks like some achievement and some success and some glory, and to paint a bit of a picture that might be the kind of thing that you might be seeing on my Facebook page, if I had one, or on my Insta feed, that really paints an impression that I want you to see. But what I see in my Christian counselling work that I do is, in many men, the need to tell their story to other men, and to be a bit vulnerable, and to not tell the story of great success, but to actually tell some of the truth. And so I'm going to be sharing with you not the success story, but the challenge story. Some of the difficulty that I've faced as I've tried to journey in bringing my faith and my work together in a useful and tangible way. And it's a bit raw, it's a bit messy, and so the presentation might reflect that. I have intentionally not tried to put together a slick PowerPoint slide. I can do that. I could put together a really good keynote speak at an international conference. I've done that. But I thought what might be more helpful for you, and perhaps more helpful for us as men and in community, is for me just to tell a bit of my story. And it is a bit messy, and it is a work in process. I could tell you the messy story about some parts of my marriage, but I haven't been asked to do that. I could tell you the messy story about some parts of how I struggle as a Christian man, but I haven't been asked to do that. I've been asked to tell you the story about the mess of my vocation, the mess of my work. And so I thought what I would do is I would tell it in six phases, because I can't be completely disconnected, And the six phases, I'll go through one at a time and kind of unpack what has happened to me in those phases. And I might even do a bit of, if it comes up, some theological reflection on what I've learned in those phases. And maybe you can relate to some of those learnings as well. But before I get underway, I just want to actually ask you a question. And the question is, and you get a chance to talk to the person next to you. I hope they like the person next to you because you're going to be speaking to them in a moment. Talk to the person next to you. I've got a question. What is a common thread between these characters that I'm about to give you? What is a common thread between these characters? Moses, Gideon, King David, Andrew and Simon, Matthew, the tax collector, and James and John, the sons of Zebedee. What is a common thread about those characters and their story? Turn to the person next to you, see what you think. All right, that's long enough. I don't want you to... don't want too many deep insights. Anyone willing to kind of throw something out there of what do you see common in their story? Go ahead.
Are they in the Bible?
That is true. That is true. There is another obvious one I'm expecting, but there's maybe not so obvious ones. What's another common thread?
They're all men.
There you are. Okay. They were the two I was anticipating. Anything else that you know about their stories?
They were messy and failures.
Yeah. They were messy. They were failures. Yeah.
Humble backgrounds.
Yeah, maybe. They were used by God. Absolutely. Great men of the faith. Their story, each of their stories begins with God showing up at work. And not only were they at work, they were working. So they weren't just at the lunchroom. They were in the middle of work when God turns up in their story. Tending the flocks, threshing, tending the flocks, doing something that looked like preparation with nets that we don't really know what it is, but it's sort of somehow preparing or mending nets, sitting in their tax booth. God showed up in the middle of their work. I think sometimes we can fall into the trap to think that God is not interested in our work. And some men that whose journey that I've been on in parallel with in the counselling room have really tried to live as though God and work are quite separate things. And I sometimes wonder what it would look like, and I challenge you now, if you'll be willing to go there, to consider as we start this conversation, consider yourself at work. Now, some of you in your might not be doing paid work, but in your broader vocation, so if your broader vocation is a student, consider yourself there. If you're retired and you have a thing that you do, a volunteering role or a caring role, imagine yourself doing that. But if you're in paid employment, just imagine yourself at work. What does it look like? And what would it look like if God showed up? What would it look like if he turned up? What would he say to you? What would you say to him? How would that look? And I think this is an interesting thing for us to consider because in our Western culture, in our world, and in the Australian culture, we tend to keep them quite separate. And one of the things that I'll be sharing with you is that when I first began this sort of vocational struggle, I had these two quite distinct views of work and faith. And what God's been working in me is a greater sense of understanding that these two are not very separate. And if they are, maybe that's not such a good thing. And that God is very, very interested in our work. I'm going to talk about my story in six kind of phases. The first phase begins student. And so I'll be going all the way back to the early 90s for student. And then the next phase I've titled consultant. And then the third phase I've titled student again, which is kind of a bit misleading because it implies that I've only been a student twice. But as you hear in my story, for the last 23 years, I've never had a period longer than 12 months where I haven't been studying. The fourth phase I initially called challenge, but then I went back and realised it was actually better named turmoil. So I'll be talking about phase four as turmoil. That takes us from 2006 to 2012. Then the next phase is counsellor, and then the final phase I've called portfolio. So we'll try and watch the time, but I just want to give you a snippet and a taste of what has been described as an interesting journey. I hope you believe that by the time we get to the end. So in 1992, I was a student for 4 years, from 92 to 95, and I did a double degree. They were becoming trendy and sexy at the time, was a double degree. My double degree was in engineering and commerce. So I did a Bachelor of Engineering and a Master's of Commerce, which meant that I popped out the other end as both an engineer and accountant. And so some of you will know that kind of context, and it meant I spent most of the day arguing with myself. In that context, while I was studying, I started doing some crisis phone counselling work with an organisation called Youth Call. So that will appear as a common thread, but I just kind of point that out. One of the struggles, though, I had was that I had this sense of double call. So I had a real sense of call to be an engineer and to go into that space. And that was affirmed by the fact that I was offered and took a scholarship to go and do my study. And if I pulled out of that, I had to pay all that back. That was quite a challenge because after about my second year, I started to feel a very undeniable call into the ministry. And this was a real wrestle and has been a theme throughout. And I had a completely flawed understanding of the context in Matthew 6 that talks about you can't serve two masters. And so I was thinking that the decision I had to make was either to serve God, and that looked like ordained ministry, or to serve money. And that had some attractive elements, but also some not so attractive elements. And I felt stuck in this false dichotomy of those two options. One thing led to another, and in the end, I, as part of that wrestle, I enrolled and went through the application process within the Lutheran Church that we were part of at the time to go and study at their seminary and go and pursue the ministry side of things. So, well, if I have to pay this back, I'll have to pay it back and I'll deal with whatever the consequences are. I was accepted into enrolment, accepted into study. That happened in the first semester. In the second semester, the principal of the seminary came back from sabbatical and he decided that he just wanted to meet the students that were going to start next year. And I met with him and the lady who was my fiancée at the time, who's now my wife. And we had a great chat. And we got to the end of that and he said, Shannon, it's been really interesting to meet you and hear your story, but just tell me again, what makes you think now is the time for you to study for the ministry? I hadn't really considered that up until that point. I thought that once you got the call that afternoon you enrolled, you start as quickly as possible and that's how it works. But turns out that a number of people live for a long time with a sense of call to the ministry, and it made a lot of sense for me at that stage to pursue the engineering path, knowing full well that at some point there might be a tap on the shoulder or an angel or a burning bush or whoever God wanted to show up. So that meant I entered into phase two, which I've labelled consultant, and that started in 1996. And at the start of 1996, I got married. That's got nothing to do with my vocation, but if I didn't say that it's being recorded, that would be very remiss of me. And I started work as with Skilled Engineering as a mechanical engineer. And in 1997, we moved from Adelaide to Melbourne. Now, that was a great year for Adelaide people to move to Melbourne. Anyone know why? No, we had just lost the Grand Prix. We're a bit bitter about that still. But that had happened. What else happened in 97, 98? Adelaide won the grand final, a great year to be moving to Melbourne if you're from Adelaide. And we met the Lewises, Rowan and his wife, way back then, and they're partly to blame for why we're members here now at St Alf's. Moved to Melbourne, and I'd been working here for a year or two, and I got a tap on the shoulder, not from God, but from Deloitte Consulting. Some of you might know of Deloitte. And I started my work as a consultant with them. And we managed them it was a long story, but worked and journeyed through the Y2K fizzer with delight. Lots and lots of preparation, lots and lots of work, and then it all panned out and phased off in the end. But the good news for me was that I'd negotiated with Deloitte that once all of the Y2K stuff finished, they would expatriate me and Joe to Japan to go and work in Japan for a number of years. So we had 3 years living and working in Japan, and that was a truly incredible experience. I worked with a global team. That was why on the promotion it talks about working in Japanese factories. I worked with a bilingual team. We were all bilingual. It was a requirement of being in the team. And we were basically supporting Japanese manufacturers to work offshore or offshore manufacturers that were trying to get into the Japanese marketplace. We were providing that language consulting and cultural bridge to make that happen. So by definition, every project I worked on had an international connection. And we exploited that. That was wonderful. Lots and lots of travel. And my wife was working in an Asia-Pacific role as well for a professional services firm. So we were kind of very much living the high life. That was also the point of the bullet point around corporate boardrooms. And certainly living what would be described, if you had to have the two dichotomies, as the life pursuing the very corporate the agenda. That started to lose a bit of satisfaction after a while. And the key thing that stood out to me was as I realised that most of the projects that I was involved with, eventually the business case to support them was somehow connected to a lot of people losing their jobs. Fundamentally, whatever system we were putting in, whatever automated manufacturing we were doing, whatever thing we were replacing with clever robotics was ultimately somehow eventually being paid for by people not having work anymore. Now, I understand the pragmatic reality of that, but that was something that really started to play on my mind. And for that reason and a few other reasons, I found myself curled up around a toilet bowl in a Japanese factory toilet and having a complete breakdown for all sorts of reasons, but that kind of realization was part of it. And so I realized that perhaps this wasn't God's ideal plan for my life either. I don't think that's what he intended for me to be in that position. And so at around about the same time, there was that tap on the shoulder. It came in various forms, but it became clear that now might be the time to go and study for the ministry. And I hoped that all of my vocational woes would be sorted because finally I was pursuing this ministry thing and that would be God-pleasing. As you'll see, that didn't quite work out that way. We got to the end of that journey, needed to decide where to study. And ultimately, after much discernment, we found ourselves back in Adelaide, studying at the Lutheran Seminary that I had originally enrolled in. We came back, we took a number of months and we backpacked around Europe between leaving Japan and getting back to Adelaide. Many, many great adventures, including touring Prague and Czech Republic and Hungary with the Lewises, so there's been a long-standing connection there. But I will say that one of the profound moments during our travels was I was staying with family out east of London, and we wanted to hire a car to go up to Scotland, and the nearest Europe car hire place was in Cambridge. And so we found ourselves in Cambridge, not because we thought it would be a good place to visit, but because that was the nearest car hire place. Turns out that the car wasn't ready when we went to pick it up. So we had a bit of time to kill in Cambridge and we went walking around. And I can still remember the experience of walking carrying the sandwiches and Joe was kind of walking next to me. And at one point I was wandering along towards this nice park and I turned around and Joe, who has an extraordinary gift of discernment, was stood, and of all of the hundreds of places we went as we travelled Europe, I said, "What's up?" And she said, "I think we're going to be back here." Okay, that didn't make any sense at all, but that's an important part of the story that I'll get back to in a moment. So we finished in the season of consultant, and we were back in the season of student again. This time studying theology back at the Adelaide Seminary. And I'll confess to you, brothers, this was a really tough time. And one of the things that was really tough about it, and I look back on it now, is this was a massive whack to my ego. So I'd been travelling the world and people had been paying incredible amounts of money, obscene amounts of money, not to me, of course, but to Deloitte, for my opinion. And suddenly my opinion wasn't really of any interest to anyone. In fact, at the seminary, they didn't want people with opinions. That was not the true of all seminaries, but it was definitely true of my experience. By that stage, I had an undergrad degree and two master's degrees, and I found myself back doing first-year undergrad studies again. And it was a really significant struggle, and I had a lot to work through in terms of my own ego and my own sense of well-being and purpose in that space. In that first semester, there was a visiting professor who was visiting from Canada, from the seminary over there, and he was on exchange, and he took me for a couple of classes. I did pretty well academically with him, although it was a very great struggle, not just because of the status and the ego hit, but the process that we might want to call formation in Christ looked a lot like conformation to their agenda and their expectation. In fact, those of us that had seen friends go through the seminary process rather unfortunately referred to the place as the sausage factory. Because it didn't matter what you looked like when you went in at the start of the seminary process, you all came out looking pretty similar at the end, was the idea. So that process was very painful and not particularly enjoyable. And I was praying very holy prayers, like, God, you got me into this mess. How the hell are you going to get me out of it? Well, he answered that prayer because not too long after the first semester of study, this particular Canadian professor came and said, Shannon, have you ever considered studying in Cambridge? I said, well, not really. And he said, well, I sit on a board that assesses scholarship applications, an international board that assesses scholarship applications for students to go and study theology at Cambridge, and I'd like to recommend you to go and do that. And so that was an incredible experience, not only an answer to prayer for the predicament I found myself in, but in the context of the experience Joe had had previously, we didn't have to wait too long for our answer. And so it became the case that in 2004, we headed off to Cambridge for me to do a year's study at the Faculty of Divinity there. We actually lived a bit of a double life in Cambridge because the Lutheran expression of the college that I was studying at was extreme in its conservatism. So in Anglican world, we'd call it high church or Anglo-Catholic. That was its picture. That wasn't really our faith expression as a family. So of an evening, we'd sneak off down to St. Barnabas, which was the local Anglican church. And at St. Barnabas is closely affiliated with Holy Trinity Brompton, and so you get a sense of the flavour, if you know your Anglican world, about what we were experiencing there. The other thing that happened to us during that time is that as we got to know and speak to the Anglican community, we actually had the conversation amongst ourselves, Joe and I, and we had Abby at the time, that said, you know, I reckon we could just as comfortably be in an Anglican home as we could in a Lutheran family. Well, we didn't know the significance of that conversation, but we're starting to now. Finished the Bachelor of Theology, and then I struck my next vocational challenge, and that was I realised that although I loved God's people and I loved theology and I loved supporting individuals, I was not going to be a very good employee of the church. There's not too many options if you finish theology to work anywhere other than the church. And in particular, the thing that stood out to me was that a call into the parish was not my thing. A call to be a parish minister or a parish pastor just wasn't the match for what I felt God had made me to do. But unfortunately, in the Lutheran church, there were no other options. You got ordained as a pastor, and you spent at least 5 years in a congregation. And so now, having had the change of direction and being the student, thinking that this would solve my vocational dilemmas, it was actually heightening them, and I was left in this next phase that I initially, as I said, called confused, but now I'm calling it turmoil. So what does one do when all of those lanes run out? Well, you go back and become a consultant again, of course. And so I went back and I knocked on the door of Deloitte and they took me in as a manager. And during 2006, I was promoted to senior manager, which was pretty extraordinary because I had such gaps in the career and I was extremely young, but they promoted me to senior manager and without asking me, put me on the fast track to partnership. Now, in those kinds of professional services firms, it's often some of the phrase is up or out. So you're either climbing the ladder, you're going up, or you don't really belong, and so you have to come to that realisation and you go for the out option. It took me about a year to choose option two. And so at the end of 2006, I found myself again without work, but I'd been preaching in our local congregation, and I had a profound moment where after a message that I'd given towards the end of 2006, knowing that I'd be leaving Deloitte, a guy, an elderly guy in the congregation, came up to me and said, "Shannon, we've never met before. We might have bumped into each other at coffee, but we've never properly spoken before. But the last two or three times that you've spoken, God has said to me, I need to go to you, Shannon, ask you out for a coffee and tell you that I am going to fund your ministry." Okay, that sounds pretty amazing. I don't know what my ministry is, but I like the idea of it being funded. And so that conversation led to many discussions, and ultimately an organisation called Delta Ministries was formed, and it was formed with a focus on training lay people for work in ministry. We were training them with very practical skills. By that stage, I'd continued my journey doing some counselling work, and what I failed to mention was, in order to kind of combat the sausage factory impact, one of the things I did a long time earlier was joined the local state emergency service. Actually, there's a bit of a story there. I'm running low on time, but you'll forgive me because I think it's a reasonable story. I went to my local CFS, which in South Australia is the equivalent of the CFA, and thought I'd try and volunteer. The local one, they said, "Where do you live?" Told them. They said, "Oh, that's 7 minutes away. That's too far for response time." That's a bit disappointing. So I went to the next nearest one. "Where do you live?" 8 minutes away. Well, that's even worse. But that group had a state emergency service co-located with them, and there was a sign on the fence that said "recruiting now." And I thought, well, Lord, this is you leading me. Clearly I'm meant to join the SES, which I did. And I was with them for 13 years, and the sign never came off the fence for 13 years. Anyway, I joined the state emergency service and became very heavily involved, in fact, probably too heavily involved with them. If you could be addicted to volunteering, I think I was, and it met a lot of, fed a lot of needs for me. And one of the things about joining that emergency services group was we were a technical rescue team, which meant that our unit had access to a lot of tools. And we were given priority for training courses. And so I was trained up in all sorts of interesting technical rescue, rope rescue kind of strategies, and absolutely truth, they looked at my stature. At that stage, I had a little less weight, and they said, "You will be great for confined space rescue." So I was trained up in confined space rescue. I will confess, when you do a rescue, there's lots and lots of functions. We did do body recoveries, which isn't particularly pleasant, but the only real rescue I did where I was the rescuer at the pointy end of the real job at hand was retrieving a goat from a well. And I can still remember being down the well. It was so narrow that we couldn't get the litter straight. And amongst the bleats of the goat, I could hear the echoes of my crew laughing at the top as they shone their torches down, watching me wrestle with this goat. Anyway, that's my career as a confined space rescuer. Back to turmoil. So one of the things that I realised, though, in doing the Delta Ministries work was we started working with people who were blending their work and their service of God in a really unique and creative way. And they were doing it as my students, but I got to see their lives. And for me, what came alive was, back when I was at Cambridge and had a bit of Hebrew behind me, I was reminded of the fact that there's a Hebrew word, there's three Hebrew words that are translated for worship, but one of them is a word avad, which is actually equally translated often as service or even work. And so I could see this powerful personification of this idea that you can be doing one thing and it can be both worship and work in the same kind of time. So I met and encountered that in a profound way. in 2009 that was part of the turmoil. I responded to Black Saturday over here as a mental health embedded professional. And I was here on the Sunday after Black Saturday, so that's the natural disasters, and I've responded to many since. And things were going swimmingly vocationally. Colin was doing a lovely job of funding this ministry. It was actually starting to pay for itself, and we got completely torpedoed. And the torpedo came from the church, which made it even harder to deal with. What happened was we were inappropriately and unfairly and inaccurately lumped in together with an exorcism went wrong at a Lutheran youth camp. And so the bishop that had been 100% supporting our ministry suddenly did a 180 turn and suggested that we were responsible for what happened, but we had nothing to do with it. By the time the apology came through, all of the damage had been done and that ministry was destroyed. And so I found myself picking up the pieces and going back to the seminary, no longer as a student, but now as a faculty member to start their vocational training ministry that still runs to this day. That didn't go quite so well, long story. Moved into another Christian ministry that also didn't go well. And so in this process, I've got a lot of questions for God about where do I fit in? What am I trying to do here? Where do I belong? And finally, when it got to the end of 2011, I believe there is a chance that at 2011, I was the most qualified unemployed person in Australia. I have no data to back that up, but the look on the lady at Centrelink seemed to suggest that, as I indicated, that I've just been laid off, I'm looking for work, but I do have a Cert 3, a Cert 4, a Bachelor of Engineering, a Bachelor of Theology, a Graduate Diploma of Ministry, a Master of Commerce and a Master of Education, but I'm still trying to find work. She was a little bit surprised. So that was the context, and I guess it's a kind of humorous way of suggesting that although I felt that I was doing many things right, it just wasn't landing vocationally. And so what does one do when it goes pear-shaped? Consulting, of course. So I went back consulting, but this time I didn't go back to the big firms. Instead, I started my own business, Tollycab Consulting, and it continues to go today, but it's taken various forms. I'm going to need to speed these things up. That led me to phase five as a counsellor. So around middle of 2013, I was offered a consulting role with an organisation called the Australian Institute of Family Counselling. They are the largest Christian counselling training organisation in Australia, and I was just asked to help them with their reaccreditation process. One thing led to another. They offered me a job as their academic manager, which I declined, but God had other ideas, and so eventually I accepted. And so I became the academic manager of this crowd that was training Christian counsellors. Now, in order for the rest of the story to hang together, I need to define Christian counsellor. Some people think that Christian counsellors are just going to pray for people and hope that they're fine. Christian counsellors are registered counsellors. They're approved. They're accredited. They're able to work with anyone. Kind of think of like an Indigenous nurse, where an Indigenous nurse can't just work with Indigenous people. They can work with any human, but they have unique skills and understanding when it comes to working with someone in an Indigenous context, like a rural doctor. A rural doctor can work with anyone, but they are uniquely trained to work with people in a rural setting. So a Christian counsellor can work with anyone, but they are uniquely trained to be able to work with Christians using Christian tools and resources. So when I say Christian counsellor, that's what I'm talking about. So that role continued, and it started out in Adelaide in 2015, but it morphed and we relocated to Canberra with that role. From Canberra, in order to stay accredited in working in the vocational setting, I had to be working myself as a counsellor. And so I had had lots of experience doing work with emergency services, doing critical incident work. So I started working for a crowd called Converge as a contractor doing critical incident and crisis response, and specialised then in Canberra in emergency services work. So I worked a lot with their emergency services crews, Ambulance Victoria, and I was the consultant that was supporting the Toll Aeromedical retrieval teams who were doing the helicopter retrieval work. just skipping over. Oh, now one of the challenges, of course, is if I was to work in the area of counselling, not just as a manager but as a trainer, I needed to get trained up. So at that point, I embarked upon some counselling training. So I did a diploma of counselling, and then a graduate diploma of counselling, and then a master's in counselling as well to support that. Ultimately, AIFC decided they wanted to do a master's degree, and they partnered with a university, and that university is based here in Melbourne, the University of Divinity. And the college that we worked with was Stirling College. And in order to make that master's program credible, we needed people to be able to teach in the program. And so it was decided that I would be offered the opportunity to go and do a PhD. So in 2018, I started my PhD in the area of Christian counselling, focusing on the integration of faith and spirituality into the therapy journey. So that's kind of what I did for a number of years. That brought us to Melbourne, and at the start of 2020, things seemed to be coming together. Yeah. Things seemed to be coming together vocationally, at least. I had a job in this area of Christian counselling that I really felt led towards. I felt this was the good work that God had prepared for me. I was had employment with Stirling College. There was talk, a succession plan about me becoming Dean of Studies once I'd finished my PhD and I had a couple of years under my belt. And of course, the highlight of 2020 at the start was joining St. Alf's, as best as anyone could join a church as COVID struck. So the next crisis for me in 2020 was not so much COVID, but actually that at the start of 2020, there was a leadership change at Stirling. And so by the time the middle of 2020 came around, they decided that I was no longer required. And so this vocational leading that I thought I had to be working in this space was completely destroyed. And it impacted me much deeper than it should have, because I was able to very quickly find work with Converge. Tragically, as part of the COVID thing, was that the mental health workers were in hot demand. So I wasn't out of work. But what I realised is how deeply I had tied my identity to this vocational idea of being a Christian counsellor, maybe a dean, maybe working in the area of academia. And I had to go through, I saw a counsellor, sought spiritual direction that was incredibly helpful. And I guess what I see in my practice often, and I really firmly believe that as Christians and in Christian men, there's something really significant about the alignment between our vocation and our identity. Something really at the core there that is quite significant. But the trap that I see, and I saw in my own life, and I see in the lives of many of my clients, is the order in which they're pursued. And what I see in the stories of a lot of men is that they try and find out who they are by figuring first what they do. And we see it all the time. I don't know about you guys, but after what's your name, the very first thing we blokes ask ourselves is, well, what do you do? And as soon as someone says, this is what I do, we just identify them and tend to make all sorts of assumptions about them. And we do the same about ourselves. And what I realised actually is that those two things are very valid. Our identity, who we are and what we do, are intimately connected. But we need to do it in the other order. As Christians, we need to first say, who am I? Who am I in Christ? I'm a son. I'm a prince in his kingdom. I'm unconditionally loved. But I have been made to do good works. And what are the good works I'm going to do? So you can see that the link is important, but the order is even more important in some ways. And I made that discovery. So that brings us to now. So where are things up to now? Well, I've finished my PhD. That was quite a journey. Thanks, Rowan, for your support. I work now for Reventure, which is the parent company of Converge. So Reventure is the current version of what used to be the Interchurch Trade and Industry Mission. So the area we focus on is putting chaplains into industry. So I work in a space that is working as an industrial chaplain, focusing in on that space there. The third part about what I do vocationally is I work now as the Dean of Counselling and Chaplaincy for Perth Bible College, and we have an arm called the Asia Pacific School of Pastoral Care and Counselling. So focusing in that training area and really feeling like I'm coming alive in that space. And then the final area is Tollycab, that was started as an act of desperation many, many decades ago, is still the mechanism that I use to do private counselling, predominantly with Christian men, is my pretty much exclusive focus. And I do a lot of consulting work and work for emergency services in that mental health space in that area. And the future? Well, a few weeks ago, Mike let the cat out the bag. I don't know if any of you were here, and made public the fact that I've been accepted for ordination. And so a number of you have come and congratulated within the Anglican Church. A number of you have come and congratulated me on the assumption that I'm actually going on to become a parish priest. And that is not true. So I just want to feel like I need to correct the record there. What has actually happened, and I feel incredibly grateful for God, and this happened in that foyer over there, was I learned that in the Anglican community there's a thing called a distinctive deacon, which is a step towards being a priest in the same way a priest is a step towards being a bishop. Not all priests will become bishops. I don't know how to break that to you, Peter, and Renee. But in the same way, not all deacons will necessarily become priests. So there's a role for the distinctive deacon. And I read this and my heart came alive. These are words from the Melbourne Diocese about what is a distinctive deacon. They work in many different fields and may often be found outside the mainstream of the church, at the boundaries and in the ditches of society. They often work at the margins, critically questioning unjust structures. They are prepared to be unconventional and challenging. They are prepared to break new ground, to be a burr under the saddle of those in authority. Not the burr under the saddle bit, don't worry too much, Peter, but I read that and I thought, at last, I think there's actually a place for me in the church to be able to be working in this ordained space. And so that is the process that I've been on. It enables the ministry that I do as an industrial chaplain and as a counsellor and as a Bible college lecturer to come under good authority and to be well submitted to good churchly teachings. And so that's kind of the objective. And so that's kind of where I think the future leads. So it's been a messy journey. It's been a bumpy journey. There's been a few discoveries along the way. I don't know if you can relate to any of it. But I guess my intention this evening has really just to be to tell a little bit of my story and invite you into some of the mess of my life. And maybe if there's an opportunity, I'd love to be hearing your stories and to be connected in some way, because I think at its core that that's what some of this men's ministry needs to be working on. And so I thought I would end not with anything profound other than just my translation of Hebrews 10, 23 to 25. Let us hold fast to the confession of our hope without wavering. For he who promised is faithful. And let us imagine ways to stir up each other toward love and good works. Not giving up meeting together like some people, but encouraging one another more and more as you see the day approaching. Thanks.